Hello and welcome to Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hopefully this recording is going to go out on Good Friday. Susie and I have done a batch of these together sitting at her kitchen table. And I want to tell you there's a very delicious apple cake currently sitting in the bath because it's got to be put there to keep it away from the dogs so that the other people in the house can have their cake because we're sitting in the kitchen. But it was just this wonderful phrase, the cake's in the bath! I can have some cake when we've finished. And as it's Easter time, food is very relevant because, let's face it, Christianity has to be a little bit more about Easter eggs, doesn't it?
Can possibly comment. I mean, they seem like a great idea to me, but I believe that Christianity is theoretically entirely unrelated to Easter eggs.
Of course, it's totally unrelated to Easter eggs. Yeah. But it's this idea of something hatching out of an egg, I suppose. And because it's springtime, we come back to the cultural appropriation. Do you think Christianity nicked pagan dates?
Yes and no. I couldn't possibly comment on whether the man called Jesus was born at Christmas and died at Easter, but from the perspective of events making sense within the calendar of the year and within the reality of certainly what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, spring is springing. Things are being reborn. Chicks are hatching. I suspect some massive cultural appropriation in the acquisition of an Easter egg, but I'm not sure that Easter eggs exactly fundamental to Bible studies anywhere in the world.
Definitely not. No, a touch of irony.
But and you know, I found the whole Easter egg thing intriguing, just to tack off a minute, just because the association with Estra and with eggs and with estrus, as in female productivity in any mammalian creature, not just humans. It's, you know, this is the time when everything is born. There are lambs skipping around in every field. There are birds gathering twigs and screeching at, my little dog Druid went to the corner of a field the other day and got very roundly told off by someone who's clearly got eggs in there. It's, you know, spring is springing. And if you're going to claim a time of year for resurrection, claim spring. So on the one hand, yes, of course they did, because pagans, heathens, whatever, were there first. But on the other hand, maybe it has very little to do with whether or not the pagans and the heathens were there first. Or does it simply make sense? I don't know. I mean, to say they stole it. It's a story. It's a story, isn't it? That Christianity went around stealing all the dates and a whole bunch of the goddesses. You know, there's Saint Bridget is Bridget, whose time of year this is. So, yes, they probably nicked it. Emphatically, they nicked it. But did they do it in a kind of cynical move to try and just massage the truth a little? Everyone will come along for the ride? Or did these times kind of evolve with what seemed correct? I mean, is it, you know, is it spring in Galilee in March or April?
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Okay. My geography is as appalling as my maths, I'm afraid.
So. Well, it's not the same kind of spring as it is in the United Kingdom, where we're sitting. And I'm really glad you mentioned that thing about the Northern Hemisphere, because all of these traditions seem to be grounded in the Northern Hemisphere. Mm. And if you look at, I think it's called the Peter Map of the world, which is the one that shows it correctly in dimensions rather than the one we see in our atlas, there's a lot more of the Southern Hemisphere that we can even imagine. It's much bigger and much more important from the point of view of landmass as well as sea. So one does wonder what it's like to celebrate these festivals of rebirth at a time of death.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. And I wonder what customs may have been down there. I don't know that much about the Aboriginal customs. But even so, I can see that's always a pattern. even if it's not necessarily at the same time of the year. And of course, my dad always used to say time only began with the coming of the railways.
Yeah.
Because up until then, you didn't have to be anywhere at 11:15 in the morning. You just say, I'll see you in the third quarter of the moon or something like that, or the third full moon. And you wouldn't go out at night unless it was quite a big moon.
Mm.
So the whole, all this modern projection that we have onto these things, I think can be helpful, but can also be very, very harmful. Mm. And this idea of did Christianity steal? Again, yes, I will always put my hand on my heart and own responsibility for all the evils that have come through Christianity. If I'm, actually, I don't like calling myself a Christian because the implication is immediately, and you're not. You know, it's sort of setting out tribal boundaries.
Yeah, yeah.
But as somebody who believes in the creation and the Christ consciousness and finds beautiful things within that religion, I suppose I probably am a Christian, and being ordained probably ought to own to it. However, I think you're absolutely right in that we find the patterns. We've got the patterns of creation, and the pattern of creation is that this is springtime. This is the time where the egg has to break so that the bird can come out. This is the time, and I've seen peacock butterflies already this year because we've just had a burst of beautiful weather. So that's the wonderful story of the caterpillar has to go into the chrysalis to die for the resurrection. And even if you're in the southern hemisphere, the death is going to bring the resurrection, isn't it?
Mm.
So it is always this life pattern of round and round and round and round and round.
So you saying whatever it was you just said about owning up to being a Christian for no good reason makes me suddenly insanely curious about your collar. So if ever there was a way of owning up to being a Christian, it's marching around with a dog collar on.
It certainly is.
Please tell me, what is that about?
Okay, well, I'll start off with the fact that my bishop made it very clear to me when he invited me for ordination, because we are invited for ordination. You can apply, but you have to be invited and you have to be adjudged, hopefully, to be of an open mind in my church, and he said to me that he doesn't wear his dog collar very often, which he certainly doesn't. And in fact, the morning of my ordination, my mother came round to bring some cake, which is very sweet of her, and the bishop was staying overnight with us, and he just washed his hair, and he was actually standing out in the garden having a fag. And if an American people are listening, that means a cigarette, doesn't mean the bishop was having a fag in the garden, in his PJs. And my mother said to me quite loudly, well, not my idea of a proper bishop.
You can always count on your mother.
You can. I told a friend of mine that, actually, and she repeated it back to him. And there was this wonderful moment at the end of the day where she shook hands at him and said, thank you very much, Bishop David. It was a wonderful ceremony. And he like, smiled at her so sweetly and said, yes, wasn't it, Mrs. Whitehouse? I'm so sorry we couldn't get you a proper bishop. And there was this terrible silence, and then they both laughed, because of course he dressed up in all the rigmarole and all that kind of thing. But he said to me that young clergy often wear their dog collars a lot, but they'll get over it. But he also said to me that there are those who won't wear a dog collar, and I know a lot of people in interfaith ministry and others who won't wear it either, and that's another kind of pride, you know, because you can wear a dog collar to show off, or you can refuse to wear it because you won't take the responsibility. Because there's two aspects of the dog collar. When you wear it, you are saying, I am a minister of souls. I have a responsibility. And that sounds very serious. And therefore, my instructions are only ever to wear it in a hospital so I can get to the patient if they want to see me, or on a long-distance flight. Because then if the aircraft gets into trouble or somebody dies, they'll know who to blame. Sorry, call. That's how he put it. But the legend of the dog collar is wonderful. And Bishop David told me this when I was going, well, I don't know about ordination. I'm not quite, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. And he said, and there is no proof of this at all. It's an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. And so many of the oral traditions get discounted because you can't prove them. But the thing is, you cannot prove anything that is outside the physical. You can offer evidence, but there is nothing that can be proven by the scientific method. You can't prove love, for example.
No.
You can see evidence of it, but you can't prove it. So this is anecdotal, but it's gone down through the generations, and I love it, and I think it's true. The collar is the collar of Anubis.
And this has what to do with Christianity?
Everything to do with it. Well, not for many, obviously, but the whole idea is that this was the collar worn by the one. Have you just broken your chair? I think we may have blasphemed, but it wasn't the vicar who fell off her chair.
I didn't say a word.
Moving swiftly on. Well, actually, no, that's exactly what we needed, because the point of Anubis was that he was the one who weighed the hearts of the dead in Egyptian culture. Mm-hmm. Now, we know they were taken out for the mummification process, which was a wonderful idea to start with, but like everything else, became priestcraft. Even the Egyptians got into priestcraft, just like Christianity and all the religions have done. But the idea was that you weighed the heart against a feather. Mm-hmm. And if the heart was heavier than the feather, you went to the part of the underworld that you might not like so much. But if the heart was as light as a feather, you went into the paradise areas, which is coming back to the idea of when you are depressed or angry or something, you don't have a light heart. So I was taught that the reason for the dog collar was to remind you that your job is to lift hearts.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Isn't it? Mm. And I've always remembered that. So the fact that you broke your chair, we both screamed with laughter, has probably broken the recording meter on this. Everybody's going, yikes!
yes, apologies to your eardrums.
A beautiful demonstration of that. So I truly believe that my job is to lift hearts. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a comedian as well. Mm. And that was the turning point in my decision to say, okay, yes, I will go for this incredibly challenging path, which ordination is. Because ordination isn't the end of something, it's the beginning of something. It's somewhere where you go down on your face on the floor before creation. And say, I will be your servant. I will honour you. Oh, choking up just the thought of it. I will be there to lift hearts. Beautiful. I will lift hearts at funerals, at weddings, at baptisms, in hospitals. Whatever I can do, I will do to lift hearts.
I love that. And I love seeing you choke up at that. And that for me too, I will go down on my face on the earth, knowing that the earth is the body of my mother, and that my service and my service, not my servitude, I've got a B in my bonnet about the difference between service and servitude, is to her. And that I want to, I perceive my dog collarless calling as being not to lift hearts so much as to fill hearts with love for her, so that we can live in reciprocity and respect and have a world where it's you know, it's good for everyone, there's room for everyone. And this is one of the places where, you know, it's, I'm sure to anyone listening now, they're not going to be amazed that the vicar and the witch get together and eat apple cake, whether it's been in the bath or not, on broken chairs or not.
Or sorry, in the bath together.
It's a classier joint in here than this usually, I swear it. But that, you know, we do both come so much from that same place of love for the rest of creation, for the rest of our fellow humans, for the divine in us, in creation, and external to creation.
Yeah.
For that divine that's both within and without. And that I believe, and I'm reasonably confident that you agree, that the more that we have these kinds of conversations, the more you and I, and hopefully, you know, the three people who are listening, are going to start to understand that the idea that any religion is really coming from a different place is ludicrous, because surely they're all coming from an attempt to mediate our understanding of what the divine is. And that's spirituality, isn't it? And when it becomes a religion, it's a kind of organized and mediated version of the attempt to understand that, and then an attempt to convey it to other people in a comprehensible way. And, you know, just as a as a tiny aside, that's one of the reasons that I totally love shamanism, even though I'm so ambiguous, I guess the expression is. I'm not sure that's the right word, but anyway, about using the word shamanism, shaman, shamanic, you know, because it's not our word, and I wish we did have our own word. One of the fantastic things about modern day shamanism rather than indigenous shamanism, so shamanism as kind of post Michael Hana, who I don't know if you know Michael Hana, you do, okay. So he's the grandfather of modern day shamanism, and because of him and because he created this thing that he made called good Lord, total brain fail. What on earth did he call it? Called shamanism and shamanic counselling. He created a way of learning to make contact with the spirits, to ask questions of the spirits, to unravel the metaphorical answers offered to you by the spirits, which is available to absolutely anybody. And so there is no guru. There is no priest. Our connection to spirit, our capacity to listen to life, capital L, is unmediated by anyone else. And in the traditions of the kind of pagan, whatever you like to call them, peoples of this earth, and I believe, again, this expression is actually specific to the Native American tradition, there is this notion of being the hollow bone. So being disconnected or unaffected by your ego so completely that you can clearly, truthfully, authentically, and accurately transmit the message from the gods, from spirit, from that tree, through you. And because you are a hollow bone, you are literally a clear pipe. Nothing in your ego is going to catch this message. Nothing's going to contort it. Nothing's going to change it. And your judgment, your little inspector sitting on your shoulder is not going to say, oh, that's a stupid thing to say, or you know, they're going to laugh at chair. You or whatever, because you're not allowing that. And that, I guess, is a kind of fundamental difference between Christianity and...
I have to admit that for 99% of Christianity, you're absolutely right, it is a fundamental difference, because we look to the persona of one human being representing the divine on earth. But that wasn't how it was originally. Again, it's one of these things that has built up to become tribal. Religions become tribal. Mm. And as soon as you're a tribal, you are in the ego, you're in the control pattern, you're in the we're right, you're wrong aspect. And I don't believe it was ever intended that way. And I've been very encouraged by the fact last year I went to the Edinburgh Festival with two other clerics. We did a show called White Collar Comedy. And they are Orthodox Church of England clerics. But by the end of a month, I was a bit worried when I went up there, because I thought they would find out me really weird, because they were a bit sort of, she's a bit weird. But we lived in the same house for a month and did our show every night. And at the end of it, I knew they believed exactly the same as I did. But they were presenting it in a way that the children of Israel could understand. Now, in the Bible, there's two references to Israel. There's the house of Israel and the children of Israel. And when you're talking about genuine shamanic work and genuine witch work, and when I'm talking about mystical Christianity, we are in the house of Israel. Israel means one who struggles with God.
Okay.
And every day I lose any battle I might get into with God. Do you know what I mean? Because I haven't given my life to God. The children of Israel are the tribal ones who aren't ready for this yet. If that's making sense to you. So the everyday hoi polloi of the world, and that sounds very rude, but the people who aren't interested in spirituality, don't want to step on, don't want to take on the discipline of it, will go more for religion or atheism, whatever floats their boat at the moment, because it's safer. You're told what to believe. Mm-hmm. And it's much simpler and easier to be told what to believe. And the word religio in Latin means to bind to yourself. So you can either bind yourself to the truth, which is the commitment that you would make at ordination or beginning your practice, which is that I will have the discipline to do the work that is required within me so I can be a clear channel of grace. Or you can be bound by the rules of the tradition so that you behave in a moral way because you're under that construct. And that second part, maybe there's a reason for it, maybe there isn't, but that will definitely have come from the Roman appropriation of Christianity, because it was certainly turning it into the religion of kings and princes that changed the whole dynamic of this shepherd who healed everyone.
Do you not also think, though, that, I mean, it is literally just occurred to me listening to you, that maybe the reason Christianity has, in some of its iterations, gone so astray is that it was basically imposed from the house of Israel upon the children of Israel when they weren't the actual children of Israel, if you see what I mean.
So, quite possibly, you know, yeah.
They rocked up here, they made everyone be a Christian,
yeah,
whether they liked it or not. They burned thousands of women for not liking it and, you know, made it bloody difficult to be anything else.
Yeah.
So therefore you get the body of a church, the full up of people who have no spiritual inclination, potentially, possibly, but are being told what to believe.
Yes. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I also think that a lot of that is down to Protestantism. Now, the pattern of the world seems to be that something good is born and something good grows and then it becomes corrupted and then it works in a destructive situation and then hopefully it dies and something new is born again. Catholicism in many ways did become corrupted, but before the Reformation, Henry VIII, who basically did change the church because he wanted a divorce and a son. Mm. Until then, there were no pews in churches because you had no sermons. You had the service. It was probably in a language you didn't understand. And you had all these pictures on the wall. And you could tell stories about them. And you could make up things about it. There was far more possibility of it being magical. And yes, there was an imposition that you had to show up. And I've certainly admit to that. And by George, there certainly isn't now, because people don't show up in their droves and they're voting with their feet. And I absolutely understand that. However, when Protestantism came in, they started lecturing with sermons. And that's when pews came in, because people had to have something to sit on while the preacher talked to them. So although it was came in because there was corruption, it also ended a lot of the monasteries. And yes, some of them were corrupt indeed, but the monasteries were the welfare of the day. That's where you went for your food if you were hungry. And the monks and the nuns fed you. So in all these things, there was good and also there was bad. And again, I will put my hand on my heart and say Christianity has done some of the most evil things in the world, like the Inquisition.
But also the monasteries, frankly, because the monasteries were where you sent your unwanted children too.
Yeah.
The monasteries were where you know, wives, unwanted wives, widows who therefore became utterly dispossessed, youngest daughters, younger sons, all the people who any given household weren't prepared to support financially got shipped off to monasteries and nunneries. And so because those places were full of people who did not necessarily have a heartfelt spirit-led calling to be there, of course they were full of, you know, heaven knows what kind of ruckus.
Yeah, but they were all there was.
Yeah.
No, I accept that. But they're also, one of my favourite authors when I was a child was called Nora Lofts, and my husband's actually republishing her work now. And she's written a lot of stories about the time of the enclosures, which were one of the great crimes against humanity,
truly,
when land stopped being free for the everyday people. But she's talked a lot about, written a lot of books about people who did get thrown into convents and that kind of thing. And it's like everything else. Some of them were very happy there. Some of them were allowed to have their dogs. Some of them had lovers. Some of them just lived a peaceful rural life in a community and didn't really worry about the services. And others of them were cruel and heartless. And that, I'm afraid, is the story of humanity. Some of us will be loving and some of us will use control to damage.
Mm.
And it's still happening today. Whether we got monasteries or not, we're still doing exactly the same stuff.
I suspect we've always done exactly the same stuff. But I think my, I guess my issue with it is that, as far as I know, and I can only stand here fully broadcasting my utter ignorance, actually, really, when it comes to it. But as far as I know, Christianity's the only religion which has imposed itself upon a nation, and I'm talking specifically about Britain here, although, I mean, clearly the what on earth do they call them when you go out and preach in different countries?
Missionaries.
Missionaries have also got a huge amount to answer for worldwide. But in Britain, the people of the land were had a religion that they clearly didn't necessarily want, or there wouldn't have been so much kind of force used in the imposing of it, for reasons which retrospectively look suspiciously like politics, money and power, and have got absolutely bog all to do with spirituality.
Absolutely. And Rome.
Yeah.
And Rome can be a metaphor, actually, not necessarily just ancient Rome, but the idea of power. And you quite often see governments being people throwing mud at governments, and justifiably, for controlling. And yet these are the same people who say, feed me, feed me. It's the handing over of responsibility. So it's the play between the cruel and the ones who want to be looked after. So we could come back to the House of Israel and the children of Israel. And I've never thought of that point, but you're absolutely right. The House of Israel can very well impose on the children of Israel, but that's not what the House of Israel is meant to be. The House of Israel is meant to be the shamanic, the understanding one, the one who is working with the divine. So it's a corruption of the House of Israel that should happen. The children of Israel should be free to play and find what they want. And again, I'm sorry. And I probably did do it myself in a previous life. I've probably got retribution to repay by being a minister now. And I do find very much on the comedy circuit, and also when I worked in a hospice, that it was my job to sit and listen to people's pain about this religion, to hear them tell about the pain that they've had. And if they wanted to hear it, I could tell them of the pain I've had of being told that my dying husband was going to hell. And the only difference between me and anybody else who's been damaged by Christianity is that I'm a stubborn git. My husband's an astrologer, which of course is an offence to a lot of Christians, but hey, the three major, well, there weren't three of them, we don't know how many there are. It's not said, but the Magi were Zoroastrian priests. Magi means astrologer priest. But I've got an Aquarian Mars, so I'm bloody awkward. So when I got hacked off with Christianity, instead of marching in the opposite direction and going, I don't believe any of this rubbish, I thought, I'm going down into this. I'm going into this, and I'm going to beat the living hell out of it until I've worked out what's going on here. And like everything else, under the piles and piles of crud is a diamond. And my job is to sit and listen to people. I'm talking all the time on this, but to sit and listen, to allow people to express their pain and express their utterly justified anger at priests and at religions. I had a priest, I went to the Birmingham Oratory with my parents when I was 9, I think, and I went up to the altar and I laid down on the ground in front of the altar, because even then some part of me knew I wanted to give my life to this creator. And a priest ran out from the side, grabbed my arm, threw me down the chancel steps and said, how dare you profane the house of God?
Ooh,
and
ouch.
My parents stood there and allowed it.
Yeah.
Because he was a vicar, because he was a priest. And there is no way that any of that can be right. But from that pain, I found salvation. But then I'm very lucky that I'm wired that way. And I utterly understand the others that go, I'm not having anything to do with this. This is cruel. This is heartless.
Back to our original purpose. You know, there's not. Excuse my phone in the background. There is not cruel and heartless at its core, but no. It's been cruel and heartless in its rollout and in its iterations in so many places all over the world, because it's there are massive aspects of it that seem to have become disconnected from its original purpose, which is to connect with spirit.
And is this because both, well, all the great religions of the world are patriarchal, is it?
I imagine so. I mean, to me, that's the absolutely fundamental thing. That's why when I was 9 years old and you know, feeling, yes, profoundly in love with spirits and knowing of spirits, that there's not a chance that I would have been throwing myself down at the altar steps, much as I have to own up to singing in the choir, but that's because I loved the music and there was nowhere else to sing. But that to me, it was so clear that the divine couldn't possibly be a man, you know, or a male god. It just seemed laughable to me, even as a child, to suppose that from a male divinity could come the gifts of all of life. That the generative to me was, at the very best of itself, clearly a meeting of both masculine and feminine. And if you had to choose one, then there are plenty of physical
creatures
who reproduce parthenogenically. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're going to pick one to be your creative god, come along, people, my little 9-year-old self would have said, don't be ridiculous. Of course it's a girl. You know, of course there's a goddess.
Parthenogenic, it comes from the word Parthenon in Greek. And what is the Greek word that describes Mary, mother of Jesus? Parthenon. So, you know, the Virgin Mary comes from this retracing back to the idea of the goddess pregnant by the god.
Mm.
And Joseph Campbell, you know Joseph Campbell,
of course,
I'm sure.
I know
wonderful Joseph
Campbell.
I'm paraphrasing this, but he basically says you can see the progress of religion. To start with, all the nations thought that creation came from a mother goddess. Then they moved to creation from a mother goddess and a father god. Then they went to creation by a god imposing itself on a goddess, if you like, and then they moved to creation from a god. Let's stop this now and continue with the next one, because we're getting past the 30-minute slot and we're intending to make them 30 minutes. So we're going to come back to this next week, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening and happy Easter.
Yes, happy whatever it is you like to celebrate that is the rebirth of life.
And cake.
And cake.
And chocolate.
And that.